I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. In other words, Jesus is saying, as you understand it from the scribes and the Pharisees then, this is how you've come to terms with or grasped what God has said in His law. And what is it that they have understood, or what is it that they think? Well, the second part of verse 21, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. I don't know if this is the way your Bible is, but in my Bible, I have a little Z there in superscript next to you shall not murder. And if you look up in verse 21, you see that this is a quotation from two different places in the Bible, from Exodus chapter 20, from Deuteronomy chapter 5, two places where God lists His 10 words or 10 commandments. For those of you familiar with those commandments, this is the sixth one, you shall not murder. And then there's this commentary that whoever violates this commandment will be liable to judgment. A number of places in the Old Testament we hear about how God has appointed judges in a penal system in order that they might reflect His judgments and execute His sentence, His decree in dealing with violation of His commands. And it appears that the popular understanding of that day influenced by the scribes and the Pharisees with regard to this point in God's law is that the law forbid the action of murder. And that this law was fulfilled or kept when the action of murder was not violated. And further, that when this action of murder occurs, when the law is violated, that the offender there will be liable or responsible to the court system of Israel. Now, what's interesting is that Jesus places Himself firmly against such an interpretation. So notice the disjunct, verse 22. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be, and then the same thing, liable to judgment. I think in this passage, Jesus is not so much undoing or taking stance against the teaching, but simply to say that that interpretation by itself is inadequate. And inasmuch as it claims to be whole or complete, when really it's partial, it's incorrect. In other words, Jesus isn't doing away with the sixth commandment. What He's doing, though, is showing that God's law speaks to more than just the action of murder, it also speaks to the attitude of anger. He's pointing out with clarity that God's commands, when given in the negative like this, also have a positive import. God isn't simply concerned about you not murdering someone. He also wants you not to have murderous or thoughts or hatred in your heart towards another. He also wants you to love other people and live in harmony with them. When He commands that you're not to take life unjustly, as in the sixth commandment, He also wants you to protect life and promote it, to care for all that lives in His image. So Jesus then is not undoing the sixth commandment, even as we see in verses 18 and 19 of this chapter. He says He hasn't come to do away with or to make null and void the law, but instead to fulfill it. And now as the fulfillment of God's law, as the one who has done all of its prescriptions and is the goal or the end of the law's predictions, He is its chief expositor. Jesus is the one that shows us what God means. And in the sixth commandment, we see that God speaks not only to actions of murder, but also our attitudes, the way we respond to others. Now, don't fall into the opposite trap. Jesus isn't saying that murder is the same thing as anger. You might ask then, what's the difference between anger and murder? What I'd suggest is the same sort of difference that we have between an acorn and an oak tree. Really, the difference is one of time and opportunity. The difference is one that is quantitative, not qualitative. The difference is one where anger is the seed form of murder. And Jesus believes that not only is murder the sort of action that makes you liable to the court and also liable, responsible before God, but also murder in its impartial form in sinful anger leaves one liable and responsible to God. And significantly so. So notice how Jesus goes on. He's not content just to say that sinful anger makes one liable to judgment. He also says whoever insults his brother is liable to the council or to the court, the high court of the land. Even further, whoever says, "You fool," now most starkly, will be liable to the hell of fire. Obviously, these are serious statements, are they not? And even as we looked last week, we said we'll have opportunity in analyzing the Sermon on the Mount to wonder, could God really be so strict, so precise in His commands?
Yeah, you remember what Jesus said, that whoever relaxes even the least of these commandments is least in the kingdom.
Jesus shows us that God's laws are precise. They speak not only to actions, but also the root cause of those actions, namely our hearts. That they're after an inward disposition or condition, an attitude.
And that not only is the outward action of murder sin in God's eyes, but also the inward disposition of sinful anger, that even this violation of God's commandments results in His judgment and in His punishment. It's a sobering teaching. I think it's important that as we look at murder in principle here, we look at anger, we understand what Jesus means by that. Let me give a clarification. Jesus is not here speaking about righteous anger or anger which is in proportion and correct. Instead, He's speaking about anger which is sinful. Now, why would I say that? I think that Matthew would have us to believe that Jesus, implicitly he would have us to believe that Jesus is speaking about sinful anger. And the reason is that in Matthew's account of Jesus' life and ministry, Jesus is often angry.
If you move through the Gospel of Matthew, there are numerous examples, but let me just mention two ever so quickly. Matthew chapter 22, Jesus gives a parable. It's a parable about a king who leaves, and the king is certainly in this parable standing for Jesus along with God his Father. And as the king leaves, his servants are to care for his property. Instead, the servants act shamefully. And what is the king's response? The king, it says in verse 7 of chapter 22, is angry. He sent his troops and destroyed those murderers and burned their city. King stands for Jesus. Jesus, in that same chapter, is angry with the false worship that occurs in the temple, with the idolatry and the money, and so he makes a whip and he drives people from the temple. And then in chapter 23, verse 17, Jesus calls his opponents already mentioned, the Pharisees, "You blind fools," using exactly the same language. The word here, fool, is actually the Greek word from which we get our English word, moron, empty head. Jesus uses this language to describe his opponents, the Pharisees. Now, you might ask, how is it that Jesus could be angry, or what does it mean that anger can be righteous? I was thinking about that this week, and I was reading in a couple of counseling journals about how to deal with angry people. And one of the authors there made what I thought was a fascinating point. He said, who do you think is the angriest person in all of the Bible? The answer is God is the angriest person in all of the Bible. And then he went on to say, how many times would you guess that even in, say, the Epistle of Romans alone, God's anger and the consequences of his anger are mentioned? Maybe you can humor me. Does anyone have a guess? How many times in the book of Romans? 7 and 40. 50 times. That's a lot in 16 chapters. If you read through the Bible, God is angry all the time. And the question is, how can that be? How can this be a good or a right thing? And the answer is that God would cease to be good if he were not angry at real evil. God must respond to human wickedness, to systemic evils to rape, to injustice, to poverty, to murder. He must be angry at these things, or else he is no longer the good God that the Bible describes. God is positively, in Scripture, hostile and wrathful towards anything that would oppose his kingship and his glory. Of course, in the Bible, God's anger is measured. He's slow to be aroused in anger. And his response is never out of hand. It's always completely impartial, just, and fair. So, I don't believe that Matthew is describing that type of anger, the type of anger that Jesus has when he sees the worship of God perverted, when he sees people led astray by false teaching. God instead and Jesus have righteous anger. I think that the type of anger that Jesus is describing here in these verses is sinful human anger. You might first ask, well, what is anger? What do we mean by that, really? And as I was thinking about it this week, here's my definition, that anger is an action through which we evaluate and respond to ourselves, our neighbors, and our world. It's an action. It's not something that's like a liquid, a hydraulic, which wells up within us and then must spontaneously spurt out, so to speak, that we have no control over. It's actually something often planned, something we do. And what sort of action is it? It's one that depends upon a judgment or an evaluation. All anger begins with a perceived wrong. And actually, as humans, we're called both to be angry about whatever God is angry about, as well as to evaluate, to make judgments, and to decipher and to render things, whether they are true or false, whether they are correct and right or wrong. Of course, our anger gets in trouble when the standard for our judgment is incorrect or skewed. And not only is anger an evaluation, a judgment, anger is also a response. We respond to our world. We respond to ourselves and other people as a result of our perceived evaluation. And then it's not only that we give a response, but sinful anger is the result of having a response which is not conducive to or doesn't correspond to a proper evaluation. And so much is it the case that humans, when they interact with and evaluate and respond to their world and one another, are flawed in this respect, that the Bible almost always assumes that human anger is sinful. A few examples of that in James chapter 1, we hear James say that in verses 19 and 20, that man's anger never brings about the righteous life that God requires. Similarly, in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 26, we hear about the Apostle Paul's rendering on anger, that it's a foothold for Satan, and that it's not something in which we are to engage in, and therefore we're to put it away before night comes. There are numerous proverbs on anger, and we see really all throughout the Bible, as we see angry people, that unlike God, human anger is often fraught with sin. Often our evaluation of things is incorrect, and our response then is not the sort of response that emulates God. Humans are called to be angry. We're called to oppose anything that God would oppose and to see his world like he does. And yet, as we are sinful and as we are fallen, often our responses and our evaluations are not as God's are. Therefore, Jesus here cautions us. He warns us about the danger of responding to the world in this way, about the way which we are held responsible and liable for our actions, the way we interact with his world and with others as we are sinful in our anger. All right, so Jesus' point then in verse 22, really this is the heart of the passage, is that God's will is not simply that our actions would, in our actions we would abstain from murder, but also that in our attitude, in our disposition, we would be loving and holy, not that we would be sinfully angry. Murder in principle at a brother. Now, in order to illustrate Jesus' point, he makes two examples, two illustrations. The first one in verses 23 through 24. He says, so,
If you're offering your gift at the altar and there remember your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled, then come and offer the gift.
The illustration then that Jesus gives is certainly one that intends to point out a principle. And we see the principle really as we see something of the exaggerated proportions of the story. So think with me if I said, all of us together afterwards, we're going to go on a pilgrimage after worship is through. And we're going to go to California. And like in those days, we're going to walk. And then we get to California. And we're ready to offer God our worship. And yet somebody says, I remember that my neighbor or my spouse or my child or somebody at work, a coworker, they have something against me. And what would it be like to say, well, let's head back to Phoenix and make it right, and then we'll come and worship God. Of course, the point is that your anger is a barrier in your relationship with God. Your sinful responses and reactions to others, your murderous intentions and your really hatred of others in your heart, this is something that a disciple of Jesus Christ must not have. This is something which puts a wall between true worship, between God and His people. And therefore, the solution is to make it right quickly, to do away with such anger. Jesus is not joking when He says, whoever says, you fool, is liable to the hell of fire. This is something which is dead serious. Now, I hope that you understand, Jesus isn't saying that by not being angry, by always being nice, that somehow that's what gets you into the kingdom of heaven. If we had more time, as we will, to look at the whole of the Sermon on the Mount or the whole of the Gospel of Matthew in which this passage is located, we'd see that that's really an absurd thought. Jesus' disciples are forgiven people, people who have been reconciled to God on account of what Jesus has done. And even thinking something like, by being nice will get you into heaven is something like silly like saying to my daughter, if you don't hit or yell at your brother today, I'll buy you the island of Hawaii. The proportion is way off, and it's not at all the case that by being nice we fulfill all of God's laws. And yet, we don't want to fall into the other trap, the other mistake as well. Jesus commands, He insists that disciples of Jesus must deal with their anger. They must not be people who, here is a pattern of their lives, are angry with others, who are murderous in their intent and in their hearts. That is not the righteousness which He describes in verse 20, a righteousness which exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees. That's not a righteousness of both action and attitude, of our inner disposition, which He requires, mandates of His followers. So we see then in Jesus' first illustration that anger, unsolved, is a barrier in our relationship with God, something very serious, even something which renders us liable, responsible to God's judgment. And Jesus also gives a second illustration, much related to the first, verses 25 and 26. Here the illustration is where you're walking with your accuser and you're both going to court. There's a legal dispute between the two of you. And Jesus says, on the way to the court, before you even get before the judge, settle with this person. Make it right. Of course, the point is that Jesus' disciples must deal with their anger, and they must deal with it now. This is not something which can be delayed. Anger is seed form of murder. This is something serious in God's sight, and therefore you must not delay in dealing with your anger. Undoubtedly, the result before the judge will be great difficulty and disaster. I like the illustration of a pad of carpet, a piece of carpet for marriage. A good piece of carpet will last you years. And if you have dozens and dozens of spills on that carpet, it's okay as long as you clean them up right away. But if instead of attending to all of the different spills and things that you drop on the carpet, you leave them there, of course that carpet becomes very messy. In fact, it doesn't last you long. Jesus likewise says that disciples must be immediate
when it comes to dealing with their anger. They must not delay. They must, as he says, come to terms quickly with their anger, because anger is a barrier in our relationship with God, because anger is the attitude of the heart which God's commands speak to. All right, so summing it all up then and concluding, what happened at that Burbank ice rink? What made these two people, fathers in their 40s, different from us? How did this happen? The answer is, they're not at all different than we are. But what dwelt in their hearts was given unique opportunity. And that it was exposed. And it was horrific. And we're told here by Jesus about the peril of not dealing with our anger. That our anger has the ability to destroy us, both in this life as well as in the one to come. And therefore, Jesus' followers, those that want to fulfill His law, those that believe that He is the King and therefore want to do His words, His commands, those of you who want to follow Jesus' will, you must on this earth be quick about dealing with your anger, about loving one another, about fulfilling God's laws. Let's pray that we would be zealous to do this.